ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, in honor of Gene Harlow's birthday, I interview Harlow biographer Daryl Rooney.
Why'd you get off the boat at all? You know it doesn't stop here again for 4 weeks, don't you?
Sure I do. Think I'm overjoyed about it? But it's just got to be, that's all.
Well, then?
I left the boat here for the same reason I took it at Sago.
What reason?
I got mixed up in a little trouble, and I thought I'd stay out of town until the gendarmes forgot about it.
And what a cast-iron nerve you've got.
You have to have in my line. But don't worry, big boy. I'll stay out from underfoot. I'll even pay for my board if you insist on it nicely.
Beautiful, blonde, bombshell. These are just a few of the words commonly associated with the actress Jean Harlow. But before her rise to fame and swift death at the age of 26, Jean Harlow was born Harlene Carpenter in Kansas City, Missouri. Her father was a dentist and her mother was a housewife with aspirations of stardom. When Harlene was born in 1911, she earned the literal nickname of The Bee, a name that stuck throughout her life. She actually wouldn't learn her real name, Harlene, until she was 5 years old. Jean and Harlene's bond was close, so close that mother and daughter lived together even after Harlow became a star. In 1922, Jean filed for divorce and took Harlene to Hollywood. Jean had high hopes that she'd be the one with the film career, but, as I mentioned in the last episode, at the age of 34, she was just too old. The two returned to Kansas City 3 years later due to their precarious financial situation in Los Angeles. As a freshman in high school, Harlene met 19-year-old Chuck McGrew. The two soon married and moved to Beverly Hills in 1928, aided by an inheritance that McGrew received at the age of 21. Unfortunately, both had little interest in actually working and spent their days drinking. They would end up divorcing in 1929. While living in Los Angeles at this time, Harlene started dabbling as an extra in the movies, receiving a 5-year contract from Hal Roach Studios. She'd soon appear in 3 films starring the comedic duo Laurel and Hardy. After leaving Roach, she got her first speaking role in 1929's The Saturday Night Kid, starring Clara Bow.
That's just it. We used to have a lot of fun, but ever since I began to make a name for myself, he's been double-crossing me with his rotten publicity. He's nothing...
They seen to it that Lola Burns is a family slogan, from Kokomo, Indiana to the Khyber Pass. Strong men, take one look at your picture, go home and kiss their wives for the first time in 10 years. You're international tonic. You're a boon to repopulation in a world thinned out by war and famine. You're
That's
the one...
That's all very funny. But how do you think I enjoy reading all that scandal that has an ounce of truth in it?
In 1929, she was discovered by eccentric producer Howard Hughes, who gave Jean Harlow her breakout role in Hell's Angels. By this point, she had decided to transition from Harlene Carpenter to borrowing her mother's name and became the immortal Jean Harlow. In Hell's Angels, she actually replaced the original actress, Greta Nissen, whose Norwegian accent didn't work when the silent picture transitioned to sound. The film made Jean Harlow an audience draw in 1930, though initial reviews of her performance were pretty savage. Like most of Hughes' leading ladies, he didn't do much with the actress after Hell's Angels. In 1931, Jean starred as Frank Capra's eponymous star of Platinum Blonde. The title stuck with Harlow throughout her career, and though she claimed that her hair wasn't dyed, women discovered that a combination of ammonia, Clorox bleach, and Lux soap flakes could give them that Harlow gold mane, destroying their natural hair in the process. In 1932, on Harlow's 21st birthday, she left Hughes and was signed to MGM. The decision was met with some resistance by studio head Louis B. Mayer, who felt that Harlow was a floozy in comparison to his elegant leading ladies of the time. Her first two films for the studio, Redheaded Woman and Red Dust, present Harlow as a sexual and resourceful woman, but when her husband Paul Byrne, the man who'd finagled her MGM contract, was found dead under mysterious circumstances, it was feared that Harlow's art was imitating her life. After the ensuing scandal, her image moved from being a vamp to a comedienne.
I knew I'd find you with a drink in your hand.
What are you doing here?
Well, what are you doing here?
What, didn't Ching tell you?
Yes, Ching told me, and I told him, and now I'm telling you. I won't stand for it. You can't do this to me, Warren Haggerty, not to me. First it was a fire at sea, then it was the kidnapping. What's the gag this time?
Darling, there's no gag. The newspaper has made a terrible mistake.
Yeah, well, so has little Gladys, engaged to a newspaper man. Joe Simpson never treated me like this.
Then why did you divorce him?
I've asked myself that plenty of times.
Despite the change to her on-screen image, Hollywood's look as a whole was changing. The implementation of the production code hit Harlow's films the hardest, causing her seductive image to be significantly downplayed. However, she remained one of the top box office draws in the U.S., receiving top billing over male co-stars like Cary Grant and off-screen paramour William Powell. Harlow's films were one of the few that continued to make money into the Great Depression, keeping MGM out of bankruptcy. But sadly, success was not to last. In 1937, Harlow completed her last film, Personal Property. She started production on the film Saratoga, but had complained of feeling ill. Harlow had suffered from scarlet fever as a child and had recently had a brush with septicemia and influenza, leaving doctors to assume the illness was related to past issues. After a month with no relief, though, friends noted Harlow's deterioration, but doctors were at a loss to explain what was happening. It wasn't until June, over 40 days after Harlow's initial complaints, that a second doctor revealed her diagnosis as end-stage kidney failure. She soon slipped into a coma and died at the age of 26. Ugly rumors have settled over Harlow's death since, with claims that she truly died from the results of a botched abortion, to excessive drinking and over-dieting. It's also erroneously reported that her Christian Scientist background prevented medical treatment, which is untrue. However, it's important to note that in the early 30s, the treatments for kidney failure that we know now weren't in existence, so it's doubtful that even if they had found out earlier, that they would have been able to cure anything. After public objections against replacing Harlow, Saratoga was released in 1937, less than 2 months after her death, with Harlow scenes being achieved through body doubles and dubbing. The effect is rather flawless, actually, in the final production. The film was MGM's second highest grossing picture of that year, and Harlow's immortality hasn't dimmed since. After the break, guest Daryl Rooney will talk about Harlow's life and career and the new exhibit that you can see at the Hollywood Museum in Los Angeles.
Give me that key.
Oh, you're afraid. You're afraid of yourself because you know you love me.
Oh, am I?
Yeah, you're afraid you're going to take me in your arms. You're afraid you're going to kiss me.
Is that so?
Well, why don't you do it?
Keep away from me. I'm warning you.
Why don't you do it?
Keep away from me.
You don't dare stay here. You don't trust yourself. Oh, do it again. I like it. Do it again.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
I'm good. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me today.
You're welcome.
To start, why don't we get a little background about you before we start looking at Jean Harlow's career?
My name is Daryl Rooney, and I'm co-author of Harlow in Hollywood, a book that came out in 2011, co-author with Mark Vieira. And I'm actually Canadian, live in the United States, and I've lived in Los Angeles for 30-odd years because I always knew that I was going to live in Hollywood ever since I was a kid. When I was a teenager, that's when I first became aware of 1930s movies, Jean Harlow specifically. It was in the late 60s and early 70s, and there was this whole nostalgic boom that was happening, and I was just a young sponge artist, and I just ate up everything that I saw about the whole Art Deco movement. I just had never been aware that there was a movement that touched everything, film, photography, movies, hair, makeup, clothing, cars, furniture, and I was mesmerized. For whatever reason, Jean Harlow sort of rose to the very top and became the epitome of what all of that is.
That's a great segue into my first question, which is, what was the appeal for you in discovering Jean Harlow's work and career?
I actually get that asked a lot. Why Jean Harlow? You know, at the time, it was because she was sort of the epitome and the apex of everything that Art Deco presented to me. She was this extreme deco-designed actress, that platinum hair, those bee-stung lips, and those bizarre eyebrows. At the same time, I was looking at Dick Tracy comics, and there were these Martian girls with white hair, and I thought it was the same thing. There was something otherworldly about her. But that's just the surface. When I look in her eyes, I see her humanity. And right from the very beginning, I could see who she was, and who she was not the exterior. That was something added on to her. And in all the years and in all the decades that have passed and all the things that I've learned about her, that remains constant. I always get who she is.
What was the gateway film for you? Do you have a specific one?
It was the films from 1933. I think that's when she's in her most classic platinum blonde bombshell phase. and they're always my favorites. If you're going to see any film with Jean Harlow, see Bombshell from 1933, mm-hmm. a blonde bombshell, just because she's in it for 95% of screen time. And she's brilliant, and she's funny, and she's sexy, and she's winsome, and she's very effective. You know, you really feel for her. And that's one thing that I've learned about Jean Harlow that I have great respect for regarding her, was that she was looking for sympathetic roles. She wanted people to feel for her. And in her initial big break in Hollywood, she played unsympathetic characters, sex vultures, as she described them. She just knew she needed to find roles where she would be sympathetic so that people would like her, because they didn't really like her.
The film that I always cite as my entry into Jean Harlow's film career is Red Death.
And that's a great one, yeah.
I love that one because that character, I think, could have really been this horrific character who they make really no bones about the fact that she's a prostitute. But really, you end up disliking Clark Gable more than anybody because he's who treats her poorly. And I mean, I really feel for her character in that. And it's amazing that a story like that was told at all. And I haven't seen Mogambo, which is the remake, but I've heard that it loses a lot.
I've seen Mogambo a couple of times, and I keep trying to give it a fair chance, and I just don't think that it measures up.
It's hard to really top that trio there of Gable and Harlow and who is the woman? Is it Mary Astor? I think it is.
Mary Astor, yeah. Both screenplays were done by John Lee Mahin, and he was much more successful in the 1932 version, which, by the way, they were writing as they were filming, which is pretty remarkable.
Harlow's husband had died during filming, correct?
Yes. Labor Day weekend, he ended up with a bullet in his head. That certainly threw her career into limbo because it was very unclear whether it was suicide or murder, and the studio definitely stepped in to manage the situation. And of course, they promoted a whole suicide angle. Certainly Harlow had nothing to do with it. She certainly didn't murder her husband. She wouldn't be getting much out of that. But there turned out to be a common law wife. And she was mentally unstable. They had lived together in the teens, and in 1920, she'd had an emotional breakdown and was institutionalized. She came out of the institution. Paul Byrne put her in the Algonquin Hotel, where she was basically harmless but a recluse. Then he moved to Hollywood and started a new career, which ultimately took him to MGM. Oddly enough, in 1932, just as he was planning to marry Jean Harlow, she decided to come to Los Angeles, and he talked her into going to San Francisco instead, but she was after something. There was a rendezvous coming between them where she was seems to have made some demands that ultimately ended up in his death.
It's a conspiracy theory that still lingers to this day. I read so many stories about, you know, whether the mob did him in or MGM, or it's one of those stories that just has so many different angles to it, even.
And for me, I come to telling people's historical stories with as much accuracy as possible. I'm not really interested in someone's opinion of what happened because they weren't there and they don't know. I'm interested in the factual data that exists. I have my own personal opinion, but to me, the jury is out. Until I learn more, I can't say whether his common law wife shot him and fled or whether she threatened him with something that was going to reveal him as a bigamist publicly. She left and he decided the only way to get out of this was to remove himself from the scenario. It could be one or the other. Hopefully someday some piece of information will emerge that brings clarity to it. That's what I'm looking for.
And I think that Jean Harlow is one of those that the scandals kind of obscure career, and she's entered into this pantheon of the dead blondes, quote unquote, with Thelma Todd and Marilyn Monroe. It really overshadows the work she was doing, which I still think is remarkably fresh and fun decades later.
She's definitely part of that they died too young group, clique, you want to consider that. James Dean, because you always think, oh, where would they have ended up? Would they have stayed on top or would they have finally slid? They have ended up doing dinner theater 40 years later. So she has that attached to her. And certainly the scandal terrible, terrible thing that happened. And what's remarkable is that it really revealed the dignity that she had and the courage that she had to go back to the studio and continue filming in the midst of the darkest days of this thing where the press was just eating up everything, making stuff up, and just trying to survive that slow separation of fiction versus what was factual.
When you were working on your book about her, what was that like in terms of research? Because, I mean, there's so many stories and books about her career and her life. You have the stuff that's reiterated in numerous pop culture references or the made-for-TV movies.
Sure.
What did you set out when you started writing the book?
There's two things. First of all, at that time, which was like 2007, I think, when we first started seriously getting ready for the book, and we're pitching it to publishers and just could not get any bites. Publishing was just absolutely in the toilet during those years. It was the worst time, unless you were doing a book about Marilyn or Elvis or the Beatles.
Right.
Nobody was in. At one point, my co-author, Mark Vieira, said, you know, there's a regional publisher here in Angel City Press. And what they do are Los Angeles-based cultural books. So what if we take our project and add that aspect to it, which would be the world of Hollywood? So it begs the question, how does Jean Harlow affect Hollywood? How does Hollywood affect Jean Harlow? And I went, okay, yeah, let's do it. So we pitched that angle to Angel City Press and they loved it. And the thing that's really interesting about it is that I think that it set her story in a certain prism that could be reflected through the city and the idea of Hollywood that made it really exceptional and accessible as opposed to just a biography. And in terms of research, the worst thing to do is pull from other books because you don't know what kind of fact-checking they've done. I had the good fortune of having a friend who had wanted to do a book on Jean Harlow 20 years ago and just never been able to find a publisher. And his angle was to really research her youth, her childhood, her teenage years. And he had actually interviewed tons and tons of people that had grown up with her. And so I made a deal with him to utilize his research. That's where I learned everything about Harlene Carpenter. I think it's true that the shape of someone's life is defined in their childhood, their relationships with their parents, their relationships with other family friends. When you see what the pattern is there, then the rest of someone's life sort of falls into a certain order where you can start to understand their personality, and thereby you can tell, okay, this anecdote about her is fictional because she would never behave that way. This one is true. So that was the greatest asset, and it gave me, in the world of, I always liken a person's life to a puzzle. This gave me all the pieces of the outside. So anything that I learned was an addition to put in the puzzle. Nothing changed the framework ever.
You know, I always ask writers, so many misconceptions, so many things that you want to clear up. And when you stumble on something, it's like an, oh, yeah, this is something that's different. Was there any moment when you were researching that you said, this is something that nobody's really stumbled onto or really explicated or looked?
What I learned that I didn't know before in a lot of detail was actually her childhood life, specifically her parents' marriage and how her parents were perceived in Kansas City, Missouri in the teens. Her mother, Jean Carpenter, was someone who I think had grown up reading Eleanor Glynn novels, 3 weeks, where it's the dark-haired, vampish femme fatale, and that she, somebody who wanted more adventure in her life than just a housewife and mother in Kansas City, and wasn't going to put up with it. She was in something of a loveless marriage, and so she had kids at the time described. She had beaus that would come and visit, boyfriends that would come and visit during the day when her husband was at work. And because of that, Harlene's friends were not allowed to come and visit her at home, see them at school, but it was rare that kids would come over to her house. So consequently, most of her friends were the animals that lived in her home and the servants. So it made her very democratic towards hired help. She saw them as friends always, her whole life. And it also brought a certain degree of aloofness that she had with people, particularly girls, because there was a certain judgment put towards her when she was a kid that wasn't fair because it wasn't her fault. It was her mother's behavior. And I think it's something that she never knew.
I know that going off of the made-for-TV movies and the Harlow film that's out there, her mother's always been portrayed as this Mama Rose type of figure that's just stage mother and doesn't really have any complexity or personality, much like how Marilyn Monroe's mother is just crazy.
Well, you know, that's actually something that I'm really trying to correct, is this whole idea that her mother was called Mama Jean. Never called Mama Jean. That's actually something that writer Irving Shulman came up with in the 1960s. And I think that he did it to psychologically connect her to Mama Rose from Gypsy, thus classic stage mother, the pushy stage mother. And not that she wasn't a pushy stage mother, but she was never called Mama Jean by anyone. She was Mother Jean. She was Mrs. Bellow. And Harlene called her mother, Mommy, called her Mommy. So that's one of my little crusades, is to stop people from calling her Mama Jean. All it does is reinforce Irving Shulman, which needs to be corrected. She is more than just a stage mother. She's someone who wanted to be a movie star herself, but she never, ever did any real preparation for it and was never going to be able to with the father that she had. She was raised to be a society woman, and it's something that she didn't really want. She wanted more adventure in her life. She belonged in Hollywood, and that's where she went. As soon as she could get there, she divorced her husband, packed up that girl, and off they went to Hollywood in 1922.
It's amazing to watch because I watch a lot of the biopic, and I did a Harlow versus Harlow, the two movies that came out same year.
Dueling Harlow.
Carol Lindley versus Carol Baker. Which one is least like her? Yeah. It's really hilarious to look at both of those movies because it literally looks like nobody did any research other than we have a character, we have Jean Harlow. Let's just make a movie that's vaguely about her. It's laughable to see both of these actresses who were beautiful women playing a character that whoever wrote those scripts obviously knew nothing.
There's never been a factual biography done on Jean Harlow. Actually, my co-author Mark Vieira and I actually have written a screenplay, which is really focuses on her relationship with her mother. The basic pitch of the movie is mother love gone toxic. They had a very loving relationship, but there was never any psychological separation between the two of them. And it was something that they were very proud of. People saw us as two, but really we were one.
It's very Pickford-esque because you hear similar stories about Mary Pickford and her mother who lived together for a very long time and never really were able to separate. Even when Mary Pickford's mother died, it almost threatened to kill her. Yeah. Hollywood needs to greenlight that.
Well, you know, hopefully 2017 is the year. Got a major exhibit at the Hollywood Museum. The script is out being presented by our representative, and hopefully the stars are aligning this year, and someone like, oh, I don't know, Ryan Murphy might say yes to it.
Fingers are crossed. Let's talk about the Hollywood Museum exhibit, because I want to make sure people know about that. What was that like to work with them and put this on?
First of all, I'm going to give the information. It's at 1660 North Highland Avenue in Hollywood, which is at the corner of Hollywood and Highland, just south of Hollywood Boulevard. And it is the old Max Factor building. You know what's great is it's the perfect place for a Jean Harlow exhibit because Jean Harlow opened the For Blondes Only room there back in 1935. So the building itself is part of the history. It's a spectacular streamlined deco designed makeup studio. I first had a Harlow exhibit there back in 2011 when our book came out. That ran for a year. People took their items back, but I kept a small exhibit there. And then this year, because the long-lost Farewell to Earth painting showed up finally, and I was able to rescue it and bring it back to Hollywood, I talked the owner of the museum into having another exhibit, a major exhibit, with that painting as the centerpiece.
The Hollywood Museum is such a great little slice of history. For people who haven't gone down and seen it, can you give us a little taste of what they might see if they drop in?
I'm incredibly proud of this exhibit, more so than the first one, because the owner, her name is Donnell Dadigan, really was inspired to be involved in this exhibit. Here's all the items that I'm going to have, And she said, okay, so do you have quotes that you can find that Jean Harlow made that we can add? Do you have quotes by other people who knew her? And what it did was it brought this whole other layer to the museum experience that didn't exist until we talked about that. So when you see the exhibit, there will be quotes all over the place, things that Jean Harlow said herself, things that people knew her, what they had to say about her. So that's one level that I'm very happy with. The highlights of the exhibit are her 1932 Packard Phaeton convertible, a spectacular, spectacular vehicle. Of course, the 1937 Tino Costa painting called Farewell to Earth. It disappeared around 1965, has been missing for about 50 years, showed up in a small town just south of Kansas City, Missouri, went up for auction. I rescued and brought it back to Hollywood with a plan that it would go to the Hollywood Museum and be available to be seen by the public, which it will be, which it is. Other highlights are two bookshelves from her Beverly Glen mansion. They're sort of Greek Art Deco designed. The 1935 Catherine Stuberg wax figure of Jean Harlow that was cast off of her posing in front of her. Her Rex Rabbit fur sleeves that she wore to the 20th anniversary party for Hal Roach, 20th anniversary of him being a producer in Hollywood. And the 1932, what I call the Ignatieff mural, which is a 15-foot-long mural that Paul Byrne had painted for Jean Harlow when they got married, and it was installed in their Easton Drive German hunting lodge-style home. And the painting really epitomizes or represents Harlow's ascension to the inner circle at MGM. It's a medieval banquet setting, and Jean Harlow is seated at the center of the table, surrounded by other MGM movie stars, writers, executives. They're all in medieval costume. That mural and the Farewell to Earth painting are the two major paintings that sort of represent her MGM career.
I can't wait. I am just counting down the days. I already love the museum as it is, and this is just going to be even better.
I described it as sort of a kitchen sink exhibit. It's really big. It's really extensive, and you almost can't do it all in one pass through. You have to come back, which isn't the bad thing. One of the funniest things that I borrowed was, I know the owners of her homes, her former home on Clubview Drive. I know the owners really well. And there's a door in the furnace room. And I asked to borrow the door. And in my memory, it was one of these beautiful mahogany doors that are on all the door hinges upstairs. But as it turns out, it was just a utilitarian closet door. So at first I thought, ooh, well, that's not very glamorous. And I brought it to the museum. And what I noticed was that there was a lot of chip paint on one side, and it showed me the color of the door underneath. It's this beautiful green color. And I just thought, you know what? That's good. That works for me. I've got a photograph of the house, a room that shows a closet door. Now I know what color the door was. So even though it's a closet door, but it tells me something about that world that she lived in, that home that she lived in.
I think it's in the movie Saratoga, where you can see the clip of Jean Harlow's the engagement ring that William Powell had given her. And somebody had asked if you knew where that ring ended up going, because they had not heard what happened after her death, if that ring went back to him or not.
I don't recall if she wears the ring in Saratoga.
It might not be Saratoga. I could be wrong.
It's personal property because
she
got the ring at Christmas time and started shooting personal property in the beginning of January. And she was so happy with the ring that she wore it through the whole production. The ring is described, Mark Vier and I describe it as her non-engagement ring, because it was a ring specifically not engaging them, but a big, splashy, gaudy ring, the same. And it's sort of a sad story, because she was desperately in love with him, and he just couldn't bring himself to marry her. And ultimately, she died within 6 months. It's very unfortunate. Whatever happened to the ring, I've talked to David Sten extensively about it, and he wrote Bombshell, The Life and Death of Jean.
That's another amazing book.
He's just a remarkable researcher and detective, and he has basically been my mentor for 20 years. So it's always good to have somebody to talk to about all this stuff who knows even more. and we traded off information, and the discovery of the painting was huge for him because he's been looking for it since 1990. So he did a lot of research on the ring, and what he found out was that the ring was not gem quality. It was big, but it was not a particularly expensive ring. It would be very hard to find the history of it because unless somebody who acquired it wrote down, I bought this ring from Jean Bello or William Powell on a certain date, we're never going to know. If it went back to the jeweler, it was not an especially significant ring. There's no established provenance. My guess is that it was given back to William Powell by Jean Bello, especially since she had him pay for Jean Harlow's mortuary chamber, which held crypts for three people, Jean, her mother, and a third person, which would ostensibly be William Powell. So that's all we know about it. After all these decades, Farewell to Earth showed up. You never know. That ring
They keep saying London After Midnight is somewhere out there. So stranger things have happened that will pop up. It'll be great when they finally do. The last question I want to throw out is, if somebody's interested in learning more about Jean Harlow and starting with some of her films, I always like to throw out recommendations. What are some of your favorite Jean Harlow films that you recommend as a great beginning?
Well, certainly the film where she got her best critical notices was Dinner at Eight. It's a movie where she steals the movie from all the other pros. So that's a great one, except she's part of an ensemble piece, so she's not on the screen enough for my taste. So the big four that I would always insist that people see to see the range of Jean Harlow's abilities are Redheaded Woman, Red Dust, Bombshell, and Wife vs. Secretary.
That's a good one.
In the first and last, Redheaded Woman and Wife vs. Secretary, in both films, she plays a secretary. In the first time, she's a secretary on The Mate, and in the last one, Wife vs. Secretary, she's a demure secretary who is mistaken for being a secretary on The Make. It really shows the range that she had, how much her abilities had increased by 1936.
And what are your thoughts on Libeled Lady?
Well, then I guess I have to add that one as a fifth. I love Libeled Lady. It was something that was written specifically for Jean Harlow and the other three principals. She is magnificent in it. She throws away lines and is just so funny. And it's one where she plays something of a smart mouth, dumb blonde. But there are moments in it where I watch it and I just think, there isn't anyone else who could do this. She's the only one who could do this.
Lucille Ball tried when they remade it, and it's just not the same.
Yeah, not a successful remake. And what's funny is that I think that if Jean Harlow had lived, she would have had Lucy's career on television. Not that Lucy wouldn't have, but I think that Harlow would have played a comic character on television that would have probably been received really well.
Well, Libeled Lady, you really tell her and Powell just have phenomenal chemistry, that it's almost a letdown at the end of that movie when she's stuck with Spencer Tracy, who really doesn't do a whole lot to get back into her good graces by the end of it.
But she gets to punch William Powell in the nose, and it's very funny.
That's true. It's very satisfying.
It's just so funny. It's just so physically funny, and the sound effect is funny. It's just a really wonderful film.
I love Esther Williams, but the remake doesn't have that pizzazz because you're dealing with, I hate to say lesser actors because the actors in it are good, but dealing with a whole different tone. It's why I think a lot of Jean Harlow's movies, once the code comes in, they just don't translate well. They're neutering everything.
Girl from Missouri is definitely a neutered film. The script that it started with and footage that they shot is very different than the final film. They had to shut down for a couple of weeks in the middle of production and do rewrites because the motion picture code had just come in and they were just after Jean Harlow. They weren't going to permit anything risque in that film.
Daryl, thank you so much for talking to me. I greatly appreciate it. If people want to get in touch with you, Twitter, Facebook, any social media, where can they get in touch with you if they want to learn more about your work?
Best thing to do would be to join my Facebook page that I have. It's listed as being about the book that we did. And at some point, I probably need to change the title of the Facebook page. So I'll give it to you, and people should find me that way. It's called Fans of a Jean Harlow Centenary Book, 2011. So just start typing in Fans of a Jean Harlow. It'll pop up and join that Facebook page. There are hundreds and hundreds of photographs. There's little film clips. Anything new that's going on is always posted on there on an almost daily basis. Anything about the exhibit, it's there.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider leaving the show a little love with a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, despite hyping it for the last 2 or 3 episodes, I promise I will be joined by special guest Terrence Johnson to discuss 1939's Gone with the Wind. I promise. Till next time.